Hey everyone, this amazing ESO Network show is brought to you by our fine sponsor, Amazon.com. Please remember to shop Amazon for all your geeky needs, no matter what time of the year it is. All you need to do is go to ESOpodcast.com/ESOAmazon or click on the Amazon banner on the ESO Network webpage to go to our e-store. It's the best way to shop and the best way to support this program, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. Okay, that's enough of me babbling for now. Now on with your regular scheduled show.
Welcome to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast dedicated to all things sci-fi, fantasy, and much, much more. Sit back and relax and enjoy the show.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Earth Station 1 podcast. That's right, folks. We are here with another artist spotlight, and we are looking at one of the best. We are looking at Joe Kubert. He is an artist extraordinaire. He is a teacher, a mentor, a all-around great guy from what I heard. Whoever had met him, and, you know, because he was doing cons up until the early 90s, and, you know, friends of mine who actually met him just said this was, he was like George Perez. He never met somebody that, you know, wasn't his friend. And that was just an amazing way to be. And speaking of anyone who, you know, whenever you meet him, he becomes your hula buddy. It's Mr. Mike Gordon.
Howdy.
How are you, bud?
Rock-a-hula. In these strange times, it is nice to be here up on the station and kind of get away from things for a little while.
Well, things are crazy out there, and we hope you can be a little bit of a respite from all the crud that is going out in the real world right now.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, you know, I'm always looking forward to talking to the folks at home and, you know, just the folks we have up on the show. And we got a great group of people up here this week. We actually have, you know, some friends of the show who are going to be joining us for Joe Kubert section. But we also have, you don't believe this, the world famous Bob Carter is going to be on the Geek Seat segment with us this week. So for those who don't know Bob Carter, oh, you are in for a treat, my friends. So it should be a lot of interesting stuff, and we have a ton to talk to about. And of course, we want to hear from you guys at home. Please write us at esopodcast@gmail.com, or you can call us at 404-963-9057. The show, of course, is brought to you by the fine folks at the esoamazon.com store, where you can find all kinds of neat, geeky stuff, including works by Joe Kubert. So pretty cool stuff to get started with. Speaking of getting started with, we have a lot to rant and rave about this week. And Mike, before we get started talking about the Oscars, we had a passing in the world of actually almost Oscar winners. I should say Oscar nominated actors.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, if you're talking about quality actors and quality personnel in film, you know, we lost a big one this past week. Sir John Hurt passed away after a pretty amazing battle with my understanding. He had pancreatic cancer, which usually by the time you get that news, it's too late. So I think when we first heard about that a few years ago, we thought, you know, the end was near pretty soon. But he actually fought it successfully for quite some time. So I give him a lot of credit for that. Unfortunately, he succumbed. Talk about a guy who is his legacy will live on and on and on and on and on. I mean, it would take too long to name all of the wonderful performances of his career. I think everything, you know, it's certainly in my case, everything from his stint on The Elephant Man and Alien to just right up to playing the War Doctor on Day of the Doctor. I mean, it's just an incredible career. And, you know, we definitely, our heart goes out to his family, his spouse, his fans, of which we are members of. And everybody out there and those, especially those people who are still dealing with battles of cancer. I mean, it's just a sad thing.
Oh, it completely is. And I was lucky enough to actually meet him last year at Gallifrey.
Absolutely, you were, yes.
And we met him at, he was, you know, meet greeting at his table that he had at the con. And then we got, Mary Ogle and I got to see him speak. And it was just amazing. And it was, he is just, he was so energetic. He was so full of life and the stories he was telling. He was just wonderful. And, you know, he wasn't like going, oh, Doctor Who fans, I just did that for the check. You know, he was genuinely happy to be there. And it was just, it was awesome. And he was just a genuinely nice guy.
Absolutely. And despite the fact that he is an award-winning performer, you know, he never felt like he was the kind of guy that put on airs. I mean, he was not certainly in his choice of material. You know, he would be in Oscar winners and dramas and A-list type stuff. But he would also, you know, be in like really quote unquote geeky stuff. He was in often not mentioned fourth Indiana Jones movie. He was in Harry Potter. He was in the Hellboy movies, you know, provided the voice of Black Cauldron, you know, TV series Merlin. I mean, he was in a lot of geeky stuff. So he did.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he wasn't afraid to like dip down a little bit.
You know? Was in V for Vendetta.
Absolutely. And so it was, you know, he was not, he just went wherever there was great performances to be had. And every time you saw him, he put on a great performance, no matter what the quality of the actual piece was overall, you could definitely say that, his performance was spot on. In any case, don't want to dwell too much on it because, you know, obviously we've got other things to do, but I wanted to make a point to mention that, you know, as a tribute to him, this show goes out to him, and let's talk about some Academy Awards.
Oh, we definitely have a lot of Academy Awards stuff to talk about. This last week, the Oscars were announced, and the nominations for 2017. We're not going to do all of them. There's just way too many different things to talk about. I'm going to stick with directing. We're going to go for cinematography, actress in supporting role, actress.
Sound mixing.
You want to do sound mixing?
I'm just kidding.
Shut up. So we are going, do you want me to get into film editing?
Just in general, I mean, we don't, like you said, you don't have to go specifically, but first of all, out of the best picture nominees, let's start with there. Okay.
Okay.
Out of the best picture nominees, I can actually say I have not seen any of the nominees.
Okay.
I've heard a lot of things about them, but I have not seen any of them. So I don't have a dog in the fight. Certainly all of them look, you know, varied degrees of incredible. So I have no idea what, you know, people, I can't even tell you really.
I've seen two of them.
Tell you like what people would want to, and like which ones are the most popular, because it doesn't seem like, it seems like this list is, I don't want to say low key, but it just seems like there's not like a sure fire, like that's going to be the best picture.
Well, the most nominations this year was La La Land.
Right.
And which is the new musical. And I saw it. I enjoyed it. And I don't know best picture, but hey, you know, I've heard wonderful things about Manchester by the Sea, and Arrival was great. I totally like that. I ranked Arrival in sci-fi movies in the same genre as the movie Contact. I don't know if you ever saw that one.
I did see Contact, yes.
So I thought, you know, Arrival was a really smart type movie. Kind of in the same genre also as Interstellar, but better. So I thought, you know, Arrival was fun. Didn't see Fences. I did not see Hacksaw Ridge, Hell or High Water, Hidden Figures, Lion, or Moonlight. So
yeah, and all of them have gotten, I've heard good things about every single one of those to varying degrees. Mm-hmm. So all of those are kind of on my list eventually to see. But yes, I don't even remember a lot of these being in the theaters for a long time. So Obviously that's, you know, Oscar season is getting shorter and shorter. But I do think it's a interesting range of movies, and it should be kind of interesting to see what comes out of it.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. I'm really curious to see.
All right, so you've seen two of them.
Yes. But
based on the two that you've seen and you've heard about the rest of them, do you have any of the best picture that you're kind of like, this one I think is if you had to pick?
Manchester by the Sea or La La Land is gotcha. The two I would probably think. They're not going to give it to a sci-fi movie like Arrival.
No, I see. That's interesting because I've heard really, really strong things about Moonlight. So, but I don't know enough about it to know if it's a contender really or not.
Mm-hmm. Actors, of course, they have Casey Affleck, who is supposed to be the good actor in the family. Andrew Garfield, Spider-Man himself for Hacksaw Ridge. Ryan Gosling for La La Land. Viggo Mortensen, you know, Strider himself for Captain Fantastic, and Denzel Washington for Fences. That to me, that's a toss up.
I have seen none of these movies, so I can't speak to their performances. But usually I can tell you that a lot of times the people voting don't really care about the performances either. Sometimes it's just a popularity contest. Sometimes it's just like, you know what? Let's finally give it to him kind of thing, especially when you're talking about actors that are getting up there. So by that strategy, I think, you know, if I was going to put money on it, I probably would be pretty comfortable putting money on Denzel.
Okay. That's a good pick. Actors in supporting roles. You have, I'm going to kill this name, sorry, Mahershala Ali for Moonlight, Jeff Bridges for Hell or High Water, the dude himself. Lucas Hedges, Manchester by the Sea, Dev Patel for Lion, and Michael Shannon for Nocturnal Animals. I haven't seen any of those, so.
I haven't either. No. Of course, if we're going by the popularity contest, Jeff Bridges obviously is a solid pick, but I have not seen the rest of them. So, you know, for those people who are listening, it's like, why are you doing this segment if you haven't seen any of the movies? I think it's kind of interesting to talk about these things, and especially, you know, plus we want to hear from you guys too. So definitely, if you guys have any listeners out there, if you have picks for the Oscars, between now and when they do the ceremonies, definitely like write in or record something, send it to us, and let us know who your picks are, because we'll play them on the air. And, you know, if you lose, we'll make you look silly.
Hey, we always make people look silly. Look at us.
Absolutely. That's exactly. That's what we do. But if you win, we will give you props.
Exactly. That's it. Absolutely. You have our biggest admiration here on the station. Actress in a leading role. We have nominees of Isabel Huppert for Elle, Ruth Negga for Loving, Natalie Portman for Jackie, so that you have Padme right there, Emma Stone, La La Land.
So, Gwen Stacy.
Gwen Stacy, yes.
Oh, and, no. Was she Gwen or she Mary Jane? She was Gwen.
She was Gwen.
I got confused, sorry.
Yeah, no, because what's her name was... Mary Jane. Meryl Streep for Florence Foster Jenkins.
This is interesting because, again, to go with popularity, obviously, you know, Meryl Streep got the Golden Globe and she made the speech and everybody loved the speech. So,
except for one person.
Well, yes, true. So
she's a nobody.
So I don't know if that's going to help her in this category or hurt her, but in any case, I do think that's worth mentioning. Also, I've heard nothing but wonderful things about Natalie Portman as Jackie Kennedy Onassis, which I can't, I never would have thought of her casting her in the begin with, but it sounds like she did an amazing job. So I do really like Natalie a lot as an actress. I think she does some daring choices. I wish her well, but you know, the others' performances are probably great too.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, Emma Stone was not bad for La La Land because I did see.
And she sang. I don't know if I've heard her sing.
She sang.
She sang her own stuff.
I assume so, unless she did a George Clooney from Big Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? So, all right, actresses in supporting role. We had Viola Davis for Fences, Naomi Harris for Moonlight, Nicole Kidman for Lion, Octavia Spencer for Hidden Figures, and Michelle Williams for Manchester by the Sea.
Okay, so this category in particular, but you know, I'm looking at the rest of these categories as well. And you know, the Academy, I can't help but notice the Academy got a lot of crap last year for only having white people in the main categories. It seems like they've really gone out of their way to try not to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And not to say that's a bad thing, and not to say that any of these performances are not worthy of being nominated, because I think they are, from what I could tell. So, but just an observation on my part. It's like last year, nothing, but now it's like it's chock full, which is great to see, actually. Mm-hmm. Absolutely great to see.
Well, it should be equal. It shouldn't, you know, be one way or another. It should be whoever's the best.
And I will tell you, you know, one thing I guess I should mention too, even though I haven't seen any of the best pictures or most of the pictures that we've talked about, I can tell you that I am leaning very strongly ones that I definitely will see probably first before the others will be The Arrival, obviously, because it's got geeky stuff in it. So, yeah. Hidden Figures, because it's true science. It's based on a true story and about a very, you know, seldom mentioned or thought of part of NASA and the program. So I definitely am curious about finding out more about that. Hacksaw Ridge. I like good war stories. And Moonlight intrigues me as well. So those probably out of the contenders are the ones that are probably going to be on the top of my list. But obviously, after seeing the Academy Awards and seeing more stuff, I'll probably be able to make a more informed decision based on more trailers and stuff like that.
So, of course,
I'm not really concerned about who wins the award, but as far as seeing more about it, so
you know, we should have a game going on here: how we judge the contest for the Academy Awards by the best trailer.
Well, you know what? They should give awards to trailers because some of them absolutely suck. So the skill that it takes to make a great trailer is few and far between. So that should be honored, I think, because maybe more folks would put a little bit more of an effort into it. Because man, trailers just these days. Bleh. Anyway, yeah.
Well, so, most of the trailers show most of the movie though, too.
Well, the bad ones do, sure. Yeah. So. I'm going to jump to it because this is one that I actually have seen a few films in, or at least two anyway, which is Best Animated Feature Film. We've got the nominees are Kubo and the Two Strings, Moana, My Life as a Zucchini, The Red Turtle, and Zootopia. Now, before we get into our picks for this category and what I've seen, I am very surprised that Finding Dory is not on this list.
I'm not.
I guess they kind of figured that three Disney movies was too much.
I think these two that they've nominated, though, are much better than what Pixar put out this year.
I really liked Finding Dory.
I did too. I thought it was great too. But I thought Zootopia was amazing story wise and animation wise.
Yeah, that's one I still have to see.
It was beautiful. And of course, Moana was just fantastic. Just Moana all the way around.
I do love Moana. And, you know, the tiki guy in me as well. Of course, I'm going to be leaning towards that. But that Moana would easily be my favorite of this group if it weren't for Leica's wonderful production of Kubo and the Two Strings. You know,
if you have to blink, do it now.
I have made no bones about it how much I love this movie. It is my top pick for last year in terms of movies that came out. Out of all the movies that came out last year, it's the only one I purchased on Blu-ray. It is, and I watched it immediately after I got it. So I definitely love this movie. I love what this studio does. This is their fourth movie, and they make solid, solid movies. And I think they should be rewarded. So I'm really hoping that, look, as much as My Life as a Zucchini and Red Turtle might be kind of cool, they're obviously ones that are not as well known. So they probably are not going to be contenders. Moana and Zootopia, two Disney movies. I'm hoping that the voting on them cancels out, and that means that Kubo can rise to the top and get the award.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I mean, now you've seen three of them.
Yes.
And you praised them all. Do you feel like one of those should be the winner over Kubo, or will you be sad if Kubo loses?
Depends on who wins, truthfully. If Red Zucchini wins, yeah.
It's not.
No, I know. but I'm just thinking, if, you know, there's some great things out there, and I'm sure it was pretty hard to pick just five. You know, for them.
Well, obviously, if there was six, Nemo would get it.
Dory
would get it. Yeah, yes. Because that's the other big one. So that's, you know, there was other animated movies out there, sure, but obviously, you know.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it'll be interesting to see what is picked and such. And of course, I know Ashley, our movie girl, is going to be doing her picks up on the ESO website this week. So, you know, we'll definitely hear from her.
Absolutely. And I have to give, not to get too down into the nuts and bolts of it, but I do want to give out some, you know, for this We Are a Geeky podcast, right? So for those people who are wondering, what about the geek movies? Like, what about the movies that we love, you know, the Marvel movies and all that stuff? Like, any of that stuff nominated for anything? Yes. Let's see, real quick, just going through it. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them was nominated for costume design, which I think it deserves very much so. Looking at, again, Arrival is film editing. We've got Star Trek Beyond and Suicide Squad, both nominated for makeup and hairstyling. That's pretty interesting. We've got for music, best original song. There's a song from Moana in there, as well as a song from Trolls. That's another animated movie.
I'm telling you, they should have had Your Welcome.
I think so, too. That's the one that I kind of remember more, don't you?
I do, too. But I also, just to see The Rock up on stage actually singing it live.
But you know what? Here's who beats The Rock. Lin-Manuel.
Yeah.
They got the guy from Hamilton who could actually like complete his award collection out there by getting an Oscar this year. So my money would be on him, actually, because he is the flavor of the last couple of years. So, and to have him go out and sing and be part of the Oscars, I think they're like loving that. So Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them also got a nomination for production design. And I think that's really about it. I was surprised that, Rogue One. Rogue One did get a nomination for sound mixing. Kubo and Rogue One and Doctor Strange, along with Jungle Book, got nominated for visual effects. Well, that's going to be tricky. Like, Kubo's visual effects, it's kind of like, the whole movie is a visual effect, right? But Strange was very beautiful. Rogue One, of course, is Star Wars done well. So, the visual effect category is going to be pretty interesting to see who comes out of that.
Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to see. I would be, you know, that would be a toss up though to see who would get it though. Wouldn't you think?
I kind of feel like putting Kubo there kind of undercuts Kubo. You know, like, Kubo's an animated movie, so everything is kind of a visual effect. I mean, obviously it's stop motion instead of traditional computer paper animation. I mean, it does use CG as well. So I don't mean to diminish those technicians who worked on it. So I just find it odd that it's in that category. But, you know, I look, if it wins that one, that's cool, too. But I do think it's, you know, Doctor Strange and Rogue One are tough. Doctor Strange obviously is the only Marvel movie to be nominated for an award this year. So that's kind of interesting. Are there any sort of categories or movies or performances or anything like that that you think, man, they should have been on in this list?
Thinking maybe Deadpool? No.
There were, you know, there was actually a lot of rumors that Deadpool might get nominated.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what other movies could possibly be that would have been nominated for something, you know, spectacular. There wasn't, you know, there was good movies this year. The ones I wanted, Kubo was nominated, so, which is pretty darn awesome.
Yeah, Kubo is my favorite movie of the year. So if it gets, you know, it can't, if for, you know, it's not up for Best Picture. I think they've reduced the number of they for a while. They only had like four or five, I think, that could be nominated. Then they boosted that up to 10. Now it's back down to I think it's seven this year. So seven or eight. So I think that's kind of, you know, I would love to see Kubo nominated for Best Picture myself. But I don't, you know, but obviously I'm hoping that they get that he gets the animated feature film awards. So. Mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting to see. And we will come back to you and tell you when it's happened. Because that's the kind of guys we are.
Absolutely.
Damn straight. Let's take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment.
In the mood to listen to some geeky conversations? Feel like the internet isn't the best place for an in-depth, respectful exchange of ideas? Then head on down to the 42cast. It's a weekly show that covers a new geeky topic in comics, TV, movies, literature, or video games every week. We can be informative.
Back in my day, kids, Pluto was a planet, so it's gonna stay a planet.
Irreverent.
You learn so much from the X-Men. I mean, really. That Wolverine is the most important character no matter what.
Strange.
It's like, you know, Grodd if he went into theology or something.
Right?
Or controversial.
I believe, and I will swear to my dying day, that the Marvel Cinematic Universe began with Howard the Duck.
Find us on Stitcher Radio, iTunes, 42cast.com, or esopodcast.com. It's the 42cast, your ultimate answer to fandom, geekiness, and everything.
Welcome back. Now we have our victim, I mean guest, in the geek seat this week. We have Bob Carter with us. Welcome, sir. It's an honor to have you here.
Thank you very much, Mike. It is a pleasure to join you and Mike and to be in the geek seat, so to speak.
Well, you're all smiles now, Bob. But for those people out there who may not be familiar with you, quick introduction to you.
Sure. My name is Bob Carter, and I am a voice talent. I'm a voice actor, and I'm a voice coach. I am well known for my broadcasting experience. I've been on radio for the past 20-something years all over the Southeast, everywhere from Atlanta to Dallas, Texas. But most people know me for my video game characters. I am the voice of Shao Kahn and Baraka in Mortal Kombat. I'm the voice of Balrog in Street Fighter. Say goodnight, chump! I'm also the voice of Odin in Smite, and many other popular characters that are, in fact, coming out soon and have been released. I've also got a number of anime characters, so if you're a fan of Fullmetal Alchemist, I'm Sig. If you're a fan of Dragon Ball, then I am the One-Star Dragon, Sin Shinran. I'm also Bojack. I'm many, many different characters, many monsters, many background characters. I've been a longtime Funimation actor. And let's see, what else do I do? I juggle. Oh, and I'm also a pseudo-professional DM.
Pseudo-professional, that's interesting.
Yes, not even a semi-professional, just a pseudo-professional.
I actually didn't know if there were professional DMs out there.
believe it or not, there are starting to be professional DMs. It wow. started off as a joke on Craigslist. Typically, they want females for bachelor parties. But it started off now where it turns out that there are so many different creatives who came up playing Dungeons and Dragons that now, especially when you find out that The Rock plays Dungeons and Dragons, of course, Vin Diesel, longtime D&Der, Mark Harmon, who created Community, you know, he's got his thing. Obviously, the guys from Critical Role who are buddies of mine from Funimation and from voice acting, things like that. So obviously, you know, we are letting our geek flags fly and it's very exciting.
Yes. Yes. Well, yes. I mean, the whole scene, the whole geek, quote unquote, nerd scene is so different now than it used to be. It definitely has taken over pop culture. So, question for you, as far as the voice work goes, how did you get into that? Was that something that from a very early age you wanted to be part of, or did you just kind of just transcend into it?
A little bit of both. Obviously, from a young age, cartoons completely appealed to me. You know, obviously, I grew up on Transformers and Optimus Prime and also Dungeons and Dragons. I mean, I've been playing since I was in, fourth grade? I'm 44 now, so I guess I've been playing since I was 8, 9 years old. But I love doing voices. I've always loved doing voices, making noises. You know, I was always that guy that loved to make sounds. And then, of course, getting into cartoons and then into video games. And then I was very fortunate to go to Georgia State University, which had one of the top college radio stations in the country, Album 88. So I got to give a shout out to 88.5. Anyway, while I was at Album 88, it was a tremendous opportunity to kind of explore and experiment with different sounds, different styles of music, different, you know, just learning about broadcasting. And then I began to learn about voiceover. And I was very fortunate that when I left Album 88, I got into radio and then I got into doing commercial production. And that's when I really learned about voiceover and about how much money people could make. But more importantly, not just how much money they could make, how much fun they could have while they made money. And then I realized that there was an opportunity for me to do both. And so I ended up becoming production director of a radio station. I got into voiceover in Atlanta. And then when I moved out to Texas, I actually moved out to Dallas, I ended up becoming a creative imaging director for a radio station. But more importantly, because I was also into improv comedy, when I left Atlanta and I got out to Dallas, I got back into improv comedy with those circles and met some fantastic, funny people in various improv comedy groups who happened to be affiliated with Funimation Productions. So that was my entry into anime. And then, of course, when some extremely talented anime actors went out to California and they became actors and directors, well, when people would ask them if they knew anybody with a big voice or with a powerful voice or who could be an incredible monster or somebody that had a tremendous ability, they would refer them to me. And so that's how I was very fortunate to get into video games as well. And of course, if you look at my IMDb credits and you look at everything I've done, I've been very blessed, very fortunate, and of course, I've worked hard for everything that I've achieved. So that's how I got into it. A little bit of
absolutely. And I think, you know, it's pretty apparent from anybody listening that you know, your voice is skilled.
And you would be you guys would be amazed because Bob is actually only 5'2", so it's pretty amazing.
Now that is funny because in actuality I am 6'7". So, yeah, when people meet me, you know, they're always kind of taken aback because I am as large as I sound. So, the good news is though, I'm also as nice as I am large, and I'm a big believer in helping others. And so as I have become more successful and I've become more successful, thanks in large part to the friendships and the camaraderie and the help of other actors and talent, I'm a big believer in paying it forward and passing it on. And so that's what I'm doing now, where my wife and I have opened up Neighborhood Studios here in Atlanta. It's something that we're very proud of. And our goal is to help aspiring creatives become working creatives. And it's something that we've put together over the past 6 months now. and it's coming along nicely. So the Neighborhood Studios here in Atlanta, I'm very excited about it. I've talked to you about it before, Mike, but I'm happy to talk to everybody about it.
It is Absolutely. A great project, too. And you just recently had an open house. And how did it go?
It went incredibly well. In addition to myself as a voice actor, my wife, September Day Carter, is a fantastic voice talent in her own right. She has live announced the MTV Video Music Awards. She has been the voice of Build-A-Bear, of Subway. She was Skynet in Terminator Salvation. She's the voice of the Amazon Kindle Fire. She's also the voice of the Kayla doll, which is kind of like Siri for kids. So imagine taking, like, what do you call it, an American Girl doll and then putting Siri inside of it, and that's her voice. But she's done a tremendous amount of commercial and live announcing jobs. And so we both have come into voiceover, and we've both built our careers in different ways. And so you get the benefit of both of our experience. And by the way, we do have very different opinions about the business. But one thing we do agree on is there's no one right way to get into voiceover. So we do agree that if Gilbert Gottfried can be a voice talent, anybody can be a voice talent.
Absolutely. Well, and it's just like anything else, you know, different characteristics for different aspects of yes. what's going on, right? So
absolutely.
So yes, you would not all voices would be ideal for all situations.
Right. But what we do is we help people maximize their strengths and minimize their weaknesses. And in addition to voiceover, we also teach people on camera work. We've got a great instructor who's also an actor, a working actor, working director, and working producer, Tom Tone, who is well known for his work in TV and film. We've also got a guy who is phenomenal when it comes to PR and marketing and branding, Dan Carroll, who is the media director for Dragon Con. I mean, Dan has been doing Dragon Con for years, and he is phenomenal.
That
and
name then, sounds familiar. I don't know where I've heard it
yes.
before.
Dan Carroll.
Yeah.
That sounds so familiar, Mike. I can't place it.
Mm-mm. If only he had a podcast here on the network, you know?
Maybe yes. that's it.
Yeah.
Seriously. That may be, yeah.
Seriously, Dan? Come on.
Yeah.
You know our network is large when we can't even remember that. No, I'm just kidding.
And then in addition to those fantastic people, we've also got Matt Clanton, who is a former policeman, and he is currently a film combat technical advisor and trainer. So he teaches people martial arts and knife training and also gun training and tactical training for film and television. So he'll teach you everything from Krav Maga and knife fighting and gun fighting, or like, what do you call it? Gun Fu. But he also teaches you how to properly block that and choreograph that for film and television so that it looks real when you're acting. So it's a great school that we've got going on here. And it's a great environment that we've got because we're looking to put together as many different creatives as we possibly can, because my vision is showcasing the talent that's here in the Atlanta market that is obviously becoming the international market. And we try to welcome everybody in here and help build everybody up.
That's awesome. Awesome. And there are, I would think that there are a lot of opportunities in the Atlanta market because there's a lot of animation done around here.
Oh,
absolutely. Is that fair?
Yes. There's animation, there's live on camera stuff. I mean, our studio is located literally across the street from a very, very large studio that may or may not have, something friendly and neighborhoodish coming out this year. Or maybe you've heard of Guardians of the Galaxy 2, or maybe right. you've heard of Civil War. That studio is across the street from where we're located.
Right. I just actually drove by there last night on the way home from a Phantom Troublemakers event, and we looked up the movie code, and it's Avengers Infinity War going on there now.
That's what's going on because, oh, man, thank you very much for letting me know.
Okay. No problem.
Gave me chills. Ooh. I just had a little minor geek out moment there. Thank you, ML.
Well, I'm curious, and you know, not to give away, of course, any secrets without going to the studio, but in simple terms, if folks are interested in, getting into voice work, what would you suggest? Is it important to have a range?
Believe it or not, No, that's not what's important. Some people only have one voice, and that's okay. I mean, again, Gilbert Gottfried has one voice, and he has marketed the heck out of that, right? I mean, that's his trademark.
I had no idea when we talked about voice work, Gilbert Gottfried would come up so often.
It's a matter of taking direction well, and it's a matter of doing what the director asks you to do. But most importantly, it's about being comfortable and being willing to play so that you can kind of – we all have mental junk in our head, so – it's about being able to get over yourself so that you can do whatever the director might ask you to do. So my job is as your coach is to help educate people, first of all, of what they have to do, motivate them and empower them to be able to do all that. And so I teach everything from commercials to corporate narration, because that's the bread and butter of a successful working voice talent. You know, those fun training videos or the how-to videos, things like that. But I also teach people, you know, about broadcasting, podcasting, kind of like you do, Mike, political voiceover. And you know how crazy and ridiculous the political climate has been. Well, think about this. All that money that all those super PACs have, they only have one responsibility, and that is to make sure that their opponent does not get elected. So that means all that money gets dumped into advertising, and all that advertising uses voiceover. So there are certain voice talents that only work once every 2 years. So if you can get into those right circles and have that ability, then congratulations, you're going to live somewhat happily ever after. But then I also coach people on what it means to be a live announcer. I coach people how to become a voice actor in terms of doing animation and video games. Now here in Georgia, and actually I should say all over the world, but particularly here in Georgia, video games are booming. Absolutely booming. We're not just talking about your AAA games. You're also talking about the simple apps, right? The ones that people play on their smartphones. You're also talking about the games that are loaded directly onto Steam. And, you know, they might not come from the big studios, but they're good games. And then if you've got the right sound and if you've got the right voice, well, suddenly you're taking a game that might be mediocre or I shouldn't even say mediocre. If you're taking something that's not quite as original or groundbreaking as, you know, it's anything that's going to be VR, which of course, you know, there's a huge market there too. But if you're going to take anything that, let's say that already uses an engine that's already out, right? So anything from the Unity engine or the Unreal engine, which has been around for a while, as long as you're putting together the right sound and the right story with that, well, then you're going to have a good quality game. And believe it or not, we've got a huge booming industry here in Georgia, where in the past 2 years, I think 225 something game studios have all cropped up. So, wow. Believe it or not, it's a huge opportunity.
That, yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
You left the poor boy speechless there, Bob.
I did. I'm not kidding, by the way. And so, like, you know, everybody has heard about the movie industry coming to Georgia. Okay. So, yes. And then, like, the movie industry has brought, I think, $2 or $3 billion to Georgia. The video game industry has brought $4 billion to Georgia. Four, like, double what the movie industry has brought. And most people don't realize that. So there's a huge opportunity right now.
That's awesome. I did not realize that. I have learned something. So, wow, I guess this podcast is good for something, Mike.
I keep on telling you, if you be careful, you know, you might learn something here.
I know, right? Well, you know, I feel kind of bad because, you know, I mean, we're getting along so well, but the Geek Seat is really hungry. Yeah, I mean, it hungers.
It's been humming to me. So, yeah, I think it's time to tie him up.
It's absolutely time.
This is the extra large edition of the Geek Seat too, because
yes. All right.
So, Bob, you ready for your questions in the Geek Seat?
I am ready. Bring it on.
All right, Mike, use the extra heavy ropes for this guy. All right, Bob, the first question is, what is your favorite geek out moment?
My favorite geek out moment. Is it meeting Larry Elmore at Dragon Con? That's up there. But I'd have to say being able to talk smack in character as Shao Kahn to people who have posted videos of themselves on YouTube rage quitting Mortal Kombat because they could not defeat Shao Kahn. That was so funny to me that I decided to start talking trash to them. And I started posting up reaction videos because I knew that they would get a true thrill out of Shao Kahn actually talking to them personally and making them feel like the sniveling worms that they truly were because they were unable to defeat me. So
that is awesome. Let's look at the flip side of that though. What's your most disappointing geek out moment?
You know, this is a tough question, you know, because typically I try to forget the negatives and focus on the positives. But in this case, you're asking me to remember, and I have to say, it was seeing an amazing cosplay of a character dressed as the Rocketeer. Do you remember the Rocketeer, the movie?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So this guy was dressed from head to toe as the Rocketeer, with one exception. He was the Nazi version. And the guy inside the mask was passing out materials sympathetic to neo-Nazis. And it was just, it was an incredible costume, but I hated it because not only was it for the Nazis where he was like pretending to be the villain, but then when I found out that that was really his message, oh, I was so disappointed. I mean, to this day, I'm so disappointed in him because usually I'm such a champion of creativity, but the fact that that message was so negative and just hate-filled, it hurt me. I mean, it hurt me to this day, it hurts me to my heart. So
that's horrible.
Yeah, it was. It really was. I'm still upset about it. I mean, it was such a good costume, but it was just horrific because of the message, you know? And I'm so disappointed. That's the thing. I felt so disappointed.
I understand that. Yeah. What geeks you out the most, though? Let's get on to more positive things.
Yes. Without question, Dragon Con. I would say gaming. Obviously, gaming is my number one thing. But Dragon Con is it's my Mardi Gras. It's my New Year. It's one of my favorite holidays. It's being surrounded by people who are so into their own thing that they dress the part, they play the part, they immerse themselves in it 24/7. For 4 days and nights nonstop. I mean, otherwise it's running RPGs. It's everything from D&D, Pathfinder, Palladium Heroes Unlimited, Star Wars RPG, but doing it all at Dragon Con and being surrounded by 70,000 other people who share that passion totally gives me chills. I even have chills right now just remembering that moment.
How long have you been going to Dragon Con?
Believe it or not, I realized it this year, 25 years.
Wow.
That's, started to come. That's, I was going to say, I think he's got me beat.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know I'm over 20, 22, 23. So.
Yeah. I didn't realize it. But I went to my first Dragon Con when I was 19 years old. I was in college at Georgia State, again, album 88. And so I went to Dragon Con and it was the coolest thing I'd ever experienced to see so many other people that shared my interests, that shared my passions. And in addition, you know what, since we're talking about anime as well, that night, you know, like late night, you go down to the basement of the Marriott and they would show anime. And that is when I first discovered, that's when I first discovered Ninja Scroll and when I first discovered Cowboy Bebop. And I ended up pulling an all-nighter, staying and watching both. And it was incredible. It was absolutely incredible. And I was hooked. Wow. So, yeah.
Yeah. Wow, what turns your geek off? This is going to be an interesting answer.
Making things intentionally elitist or exclusive. You know, I mean, so often when we get into fantasy or sci-fi or whatever it is, it's to escape reality and it's to make our own reality. And so, especially me, I always try to be inclusive of others, to welcome them into my own circle of, you know, augmented reality or fantasy or whatever it is that we can make more real. But then, you know, when you see or hear other people who are intentionally trying to shut other people out, you know, because they're trying to make themselves feel bigger or feel smarter or just feel cooler, you know, I mean, we became geeks because, you know, we weren't doing the quote unquote cool things. We were doing our own thing and then it became cool. And that's what's so important, you know, do your thing. But then when you see people that are trying to shut others down for their passions, that is not cool, man. Seriously, uncool.
Absolutely.
You hit that one on the head. Perfect. What fictional character would you like to meet the most?
Dungeon Master from the old Dungeons and Dragons cartoon. Dungeon Master.
Right to the point. I like that.
Yeah.
What fictional character would you like to meet the least?
In that same vein, Tiamat. Right? I mean, the five-headed dragon queen of avarice, greed, and I mean, she's the dragon queen. So yeah, Tiamat.
Well, glad you thought these through already.
Thank you.
What is your favorite geek word, phrase, quote, or pose?
Is it gaming? Is it campaign? Here it is. Here we go. Grats, you leveled ding.
For those who don't know, where'd you find that one?
Well, it comes from everything. It comes from EverQuest. It comes from World of Warcraft. It comes from, you know, just the gaming slang of congratulations, which gets shortened when you're typing to congrats, which gets shortened even more and abbreviated to grats. And then, of course, it's you leveled. So that's everything from you leveled, it's your birthday, happy, you know, congratulations, you leveled, to you leveled in game, to you leveled in life, right? You got a job promotion, you graduated from school, you finished your class, and now you're one grade higher. You leveled. Yeah, you got your driver's license, you've got the ultimate job, you're having a baby, you're getting married, whatever it is, you leveled. Congratulations, ding.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I like that a lot, actually.
Well, see, we're not gamers.
No,
so we missed out on that.
That's why we were like, you heard little crickets going when you know.
Yes. Okay.
What is your ideal geek occupation?
Believe it or not, I am actually living my dream. I am a voice actor. But again, I would like to be my true dream would be to be a professional dungeon master where I could do it 40 hours a week. And get paid for it. I do it 40 hours a week already and don't get paid for it. I'm in multiple games right now because that is my addiction. But to be a professional dungeon master and voice actor and convention star, because I love conventions. I thrive on people. I thrive on social interaction.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. That is awesome. What geek occupation would you not like to do?
Yeah, see, that's a tough question because there are so many things that I do like to do. But I think if it were something that I would not like to do, believe it or not, the one that popped into my head was security, trying to keep people out.
Oh,
because again, I'm all about bringing people in. I'm all about saying, hey, you want to be a part of this? Then come on in and join us. Let's play. You know, whether you've got years of experience or you have no experience, but if it's something that you're interested in, good, then let's play. Cause that's what I'm about. That's what I'm all about. I'm all about, you know, helping people move forward.
That's awesome. That is really awesome. All right, Bob, you almost made it. Are you ready for your final question in the geek seat?
Okay, hit me.
Okay, what is your ultimate geek fantasy?
Ultimate geek fantasy is to be surrounded by a bunch of my very best friends, my wife, and we've all got, we're all in an all-inclusive resort somewhere for a week. And it's a nonstop game fest. So I've got, say, 6 or 8 other people there. And it's just going to be a nonstop gaming session where we just game, we party, we have a good time, we go out on the beach. I don't know if it's going to be in Vegas. I don't know if it's going to be on the beach. I don't know if it's going to be in the mountains. But it's a gaming retreat, and it's nonstop for an entire week, and it's all the gaming we can handle. And it's just you're going to go from level 1 to, if possible, level 20 or level 30 in that entire time, which also means very little sleep. But that would be my ultimate geek fantasy.
That is awesome.
All the gaming you can handle. I got a feeling that's like me going into a all-you-can-eat buffet. They'd have the work cut out for them for that. Yes.
Especially if it was at a tiki lounge. You know, forget it.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Well, see, if it's an all-inclusive resort somewhere, it is. It's all you can eat, and it's all you can game.
Awesome.
Yeah, you know what? I need to figure out a way to do one of those cruise ships like that. You know how they have those rock cruises or whatever? I need to figure out some kind of a gaming cruise.
I am surprised they don't have that. Actually, they just actually had a Comic-Con on a cruise ship a couple weeks ago, and I thought, wow. I mean, if they can really make, you know, sort of these things more common, you'll start to see all kinds of conventions pop up.
True. That is very true. That's an interesting idea.
Well, Mr. Bob Carter, guess what? You have made it through the geek seat. Congratulations, Mr. Mike Gordon. Tell the young man what he's won.
You have won a lifetime subscription to the ESO Network, a value easily worth $14.02.
He dropped? Oh, my God.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
It is a pleasure and an honor. Thank you, very, very much.
It's an election year, so it doesn't really translate well. But as far as the money goes, yes, when you leave the station, it really drops in value. So.
Well, thank you, guys. Well, if I could, I'd like to go ahead and plug the Neighborhood Studio. By all means, we would love for people to come and find out more, no matter where they're from. If they want to meet in person or if they want to take lessons over the phone or online on Skype, by all means, we're more than happy to help them achieve their goals. Again, our goal is to help aspiring creatives become working creatives, and we train you how to do that.
Awesome. And where can they find that online?
Right. NeighborhoodStudiosAtlanta.com. NeighborhoodStudioAtlanta.com or call me 678-561-HUGE. 678-561-HUGE 4843.
I love it. And we'll definitely have those show links or those links in our show notes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you very much for the opportunity, guys. This was a lot of fun.
No problem.
It was fun. We're definitely going to have to have you on our Dragon Con report at some point this year.
Yes, I would love that.
Absolutely. So we talk all about Dragon Con.
I would love that.
Let's take a quick break, and we'll be back in a moment. We're going to be looking at the artwork of Joe Kubert. Hey, everyone. Welcome back. We are now here to talk all about Joe Kubert, true Hall of Fame artist, if you ever had one out there. He just had a love affair with the industry starting in the 1940s and all the way up into the 90s. And, so popular that he actually, wanted to share, play it forward. Like Bob was talking in our previous segment, playing it forward and started his own school. And, now his legacy is being carried on by his two sons. And, where do you even start? When you think of Kubert, you think of Sergeant Rock or you think of Hawkman. As for me, and that's what was my first experience with Golden Age, comics and seeing him and doing that. What about you guys out there? We have a great crew to talk all about it. We're going to welcome, of course, the one and only award-winning artist, Mr. Mark Maddox.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for having me on the show.
No problem. And returning from Chicken Town, we got Kevin.
Hello. Good to be back up here on the station, guys.
Hey, the teleporter was being generous tonight. It decided, let's pick, when we did Russian roulette, to see who we wanted on the station. It just beamed you aboard and said, okay, you're talking about Kubert.
I can do that.
So I was worried that when I saw Chicken Town come up, I said, oh God, is Cornflake going to talk about Joe Kubert?
She could probably talk more about the other Kubert, the hopping on the pyramid video game dude with the big nose.
Touche. No relation at all. But they were doing it in honor of the artist, right?
That's right.
They were all big fans at the production house there. All right, let's get started. What, Kubert is so, his style, is like, nothing else. I don't think it's ever really been copied before. He's almost like a one of a kind. When you see a Kubert cover, a Kubert interior art, right from the start, you're in for something big. And, that was really awesome with it. What was your guys' first, when did you first capture it? Mark, you're the oldest one here, so we'll go with you.
Yeah. The thing is, I was living in Germany at the time, and I was like 5 years old, and I was too young to go to school. And my older brother and older sister, they left to go to school. And it was like, there was one day because we lived out what they called on the economy. We lived out in the farmland because there was too many military people at the base. So they had to have some of us out in the country, which was great. I mean, this was wonderful, but One day my brother and sister were gone and I was like outside playing, and I went to the neighbor's house upstairs. An Air Force captain and his wife was there at the house, and she goes, "You know what? You want to come on in and look at, come on in and play in Wes's room." That was her son, and he was a huge like G.I. Joe fan and Army and all that kind of stuff. And I went into the room, and there was a gigantic, and I this is the best of my memory. I've always kind of looked for this particular book and haven't found it, but it was like a real thick DC comic. I remember it had like a purple cover, and it was Sergeant Rock was on the cover. It was like some giant Sergeant Rock, like, it wasn't 100 pages, but it was like a super thick annual or something of the Sergeant Rock. And I was like, wow, this is so cool. I mean, this is just so cool and so gritty. And within that same year or so, we would go like to the Air Force PX, and we would see stuff like Star Spangled War Stories, where you had, now even cooler, you had army men fighting dinosaurs. And Kubert's style was so – he's the only artist out of comic book artists, I say he looks like a guy who is actually drawing. And it might be kind of a hard thing to say, but it's like everybody else's stuff is so polished. Jack Kirby's was polished up by Joe Sinnott, and everybody had somebody like following up behind them and inking and everything like that. But Kubert's stuff actually looked like a guy who was drawing in a sketchbook or something all the time. And, I'll leave it there with my first impression of it. But that to me is what makes him completely different from almost any other comic book artist, at least at that time. You know, there's some guys now that have that same look. But, man, I'll tell you what, that is still his signature.
What about you, Kevin?
My first exposure to Kubert was probably just all the covers that he was doing for DC in the 70s and 80s. I mean, I was a DC kid and I was a superhero kid, so I wasn't reading a lot of the war books. So I think, Sergeant Rock and Enemy Ace, I didn't see a lot of that at the time. But he was doing so many covers for a lot of the superhero stuff. So that was a lot of the superhero work that he did at that time was usually on the covers, and they were great covers, of course. And yeah, Mark, I had that same thought about his work in that it looks very drawn. It's clearly drawn. You can see the lines and you can imagine the guy with the pen at the desk making those lines. Mm-hmm. And he's just such a master of it though. Mm-hmm. And I think, and part of the reason probably that it looks so clearly this was drawn is that he worked very quickly. He was also known as a guy that could work fast, and he didn't labor over each line. He knew exactly what he wanted to draw, and he would draw it right the first time. And he drew very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, exactly. What about you, Mikey?
I would have to say, much like Kevin, I wasn't immediately drawn to a lot of the war books, but I definitely remember having some copies of G.I. Combat. Probably some copies of maybe Unknown Soldier, I definitely, whenever I think of him, that Sergeant Rock, Easy Company, the war books that DC was putting out, that comes to mind immediately for me. I know that as well as the look. Absolutely. I mean, you can definitely tell when Joe's drawing something, or when there's a cover or the interiors, there's something like, in addition to being, penciled, and just, there's a lot of testosterone there. Like his stuff just oozes like manliness, I mean, he's got those muscles, but they're not like superhero muscles. They're like real muscles. They're like I think, I don't know what the time frame is, but I could definitely see where like Kubert and Neil Adams might have went to similar schools of thought in terms of their artwork. Mm-hmm. Although Adams is something a little bit different. He gets into the more sort of like more sinewy, if I can use that, maybe sort of figures. Whereas as Joes are just like these guys that look like they're built strong. They don't look superhuman. But they look tough. They look like if you were to like hit one of them, it would be solid, you know, like they're solid figures.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
It's the sinewy. It's the, I like with Tarzan, I've been in the jungle. I swing from a vine. I fight, I swim. So I've got more of the build of a swimmer than I do of a Schwarzenegger, and the sinuous and his scratchy line work. And I don't mean that in a negative way.
No.
Puts it perfect for war and for Tarzan. I mean, it's just, you know, out of the DC guys that did this stuff, he was the best.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And for me, it always felt like his characters, you could feel the muscles and, you know, literally you could see them rippling and such. These guys were cut. Even characters like, you know, Sergeant Rock or his Hawkman, you could see like the chest muscles and the abs and the arm muscles. It was just amazing. And just how rough but finished it looked. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would think, you know, if like, you know, I'm younger and I just want to start drawing people, right? I would say like, if I have a stack of comics there, if I'm going to try to learn anatomy, I'm going to learn from Joe Kubert.
Yep.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. You don't learn anatomy from Jack Kirby. But what you learn from Jack Kirby is, and even Kubert and other people like Neil Adams said, with him you didn't need to. Gil Kane's another great one, but with Kirby it was like this, almost like forget it. This is my shorthand for fighting and punching and leaping. But with Kubert there was a reality. It was reality based, and he knew all the muscles. He knew the muscles of the chest, the back, the legs. I mean, it was just he knew it. But he never ever sat there and painfully drew it the way some artists do and murder it. He was like, yeah, this is about where it's supposed to be. Boom, you know. And then he would put the energy in it. He never lost the energy.
Mm-mm, exactly. And you could almost see, you know, how when I was learning how to draw figures, how you started like with the circles for the faces, and you know, then you put the torso in and the arms and stuff. You could actually almost see in his drawings how he laid that out. And it's just amazing because, you know, being for me, he was one of the people I studied when I was studying cartooning when I was in junior high and high school. You know, he was the teacher was like, look at you, Kubert. If you want to learn how to do anatomy, look at his characters. If you want to do a ripped person, don't look at somebody like John Byrne. Don't look at somebody like Jack Kirby or, you know, that type of thing. Because
don't look at Will Eisner.
Oh, no. Eisner had a whole different, that's a whole different story on itself.
Oh, yeah.
So
for another show.
Exactly. But yeah, it was just amazing. And then, you know, just his characters coming to life, and you know, he did, you know, anyone you could think of, you know, mostly, you know, from fiction, you would see Joe Kubert doing it. But he's, like you said, he's mostly known for his war stories and for his Hawkman from DC.
He is. I mean, he did, you know, as Kevin pointed out, he did a lot of covers, and to that point, I will say, in addition to you know, his figures and his anatomy, I would say that he definitely understood cover composition.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
I mean, when you look at his covers, they're dynamic. They sell you. I mean, you look at that cover and you're like, I've got to buy that. And unfortunately, as a DC guy, the one thing is Like, that's a great cover. You buy the book, you open up, oh, he didn't do the interior. I mean, he did so many covers, especially for superhero stuff, but he didn't do the interiors for them. Yep. So, yeah, sometimes it didn't hold up afterwards. But the covers grabbed you. I mean, he did so many war covers, whether it was G.I. Combat, Sergeant Rock, you know, et cetera, Haunted Tank, it's, you know, all that stuff. Mm. And yet, when you look at them, they're all different. They're all dynamic. They're different. Like, they're intense. You know, how many times can we see Sergeant Rock on the cover just gritting his teeth, you know, saying war is hell or something similar, right? But yet, he manages to pull it off every time.
Yeah. The thing is, I had never really seen the Hawkman, the original, well, not the original Hawkman, but the Silver Age Hawkman until the 1980s when they published, I think it was like the first 10 issues or something like that in a trade paperback.
Yes.
And when I got that, I'm like, this is gold. I mean, this is great stuff. I mean, Hawkman and his partner, Lady Hawk or whatever, and they're like they're grabbing like he's grabbing an anchor with a big old chain and swinging it over his head and getting ready to bust a giant dinosaur in the head. I swear, I was reading that thing while I was playing the music from Conan the Barbarian, and it perfectly fit with it. And I'm like, this is the coolest. Why is this not in a movie? You know, weird stuff that you could not normally get away with. Weird, odd science fiction, like giant eagles with like these weird masks of humans on top of their head firing lasers out of their eyes. If anybody else had done it, I think you would have just been like, oh, brother. But with him, it worked. Superb composition. Once again, the texture and everything. And he never varied. Something about Kubert's men too, especially like in their faces, there was this real sort of, and especially like with Tarzan, you look at Kubert Tarzan face, a very dark face, like real, almost like William Shatner makeup from first season Star Trek. I mean, the sort of like, you know, deep, dark expressions on their faces. These are tough people that have been through a lot. So yeah. Okay. Now I'm talking too much.
Well, that Hawkman, trade paperback from the late 80s, Mark, that collected the early Silver Age run. That was a very unusual book at the time. That was before the trade paperback era, where just everything's collected all the time. And it's telling, I think, that someone at DC thought we should collect these and put them out right now. And that was a very expensive book at the time, too. I think it had a $20 cover price on it. And people were taken aback by what is this and why does it cost so much?
Totally worth it.
Absolutely. The first couple of those Hawkman stories, that's when he didn't have the wings on his helmet. So that his it's a very strange look to that character, yeah, that you only saw a couple of times, because early on in the Silver Age run, they put those wings back on. And Hawkman was a character that Kubert was associated with in the 40s.
Yeah.
Like he drew a lot of Hawkman, the Golden Age Hawkman, way back in the 40s, both in his own strip and also the Hawkman chapters in the Justice Society stories.
It's interesting too. I mean, I have a few of those Golden Age Kubert reprints, and I'm telling you, he learned a lot in between the Golden Age and the Silver Age. I mean,
oh, he was a kid,
but it was, his stuff still showed more promise than a lot of guys in the Golden Age. But by the time he hit the Silver Age, man, he was slick.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, but when we say he was a kid, we don't mean he was 20. We mean he was like 14, maybe. That there's varying accounts as to when he actually started, but he was, by his mid-teens, he was a professional comic book artist.
Yeah, because literally he was 1926, so his earliest stuff was like 43. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he was, you know, 15 years old when he first started doing those.
Yeah. Boy, talk about jumping in. Mm-hmm. I wish I had done that.
Yeah, well, things were wild back then. The Golden Age, it was the Wild West. You know, that was a whole new industry, and it was just these Depression era kids were just kicking in the doors and cranking out the work. And some of them were great, and some of them were awful. But there was this huge boom in publishing, and there was a demand for pages, and these kids were just cranking it out.
And they would have paid you a nice shiny quarter for that page.
Yeah, yep. There's a lot of stories about stuff like, you know, the kids going into the bathroom, the men's room of whatever building they were working in, breaking up some tiles and turning it into a stove, like heating it up and then getting a can of soup and putting it on top of the tile and heating it up to eat. I mean, and freezing the whole time they were working, you know, so.
Yeah, there's one crazy story like that. There was a blizzard, I think, in that story, and some cartoonists were – yeah, they pried a tile off the wall and they were frying eggs, I think, or something.
Yeah, it was
crazy times, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And they were just cranking it out. I mean, these guys were just cranking out comics. I think some artists were working on multiple titles, right, at the same time.
Oh, yeah. And there were the shops back then, you know, the Eisner-Iger shop and the Harry Chesler shop where they – believe Kubert may have started there. There's varying accounts, and he even told the story different ways at different times. But those shops, like the Harry Chesler shop, they weren't publishers. They were just studios that would hire a bunch of kids and stick them in a room and draw and draw and draw. And then they would just sell pages of finished comic stories to the publishers. So that's what it was, these crazy cartoonist sweatshops where they were just cranking out all this work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Nope, it's interesting stuff, and it's great because, you know, then he started his school, and I actually knew some people who took classes there.
Oh, my parents, they were about two steps away from sending me there, but then, you know, I looked at my dad, and he's like, he's a hardworking guy and all that kind of stuff, but I looked at the prices at that time, and I was like, I can't do this to him. You know, I know he would send you to college. As long as you're learning, I'll pay for it, or help pay for it. And the prices were reasonable, really. They are reasonable considering, but it was such a thing. And then, you know, it's like there's guys here in Tallahassee. You're like, hey, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, the Joe Kubert School. Oh, yeah, I went to that school. And you just want to kill them. Mm-hmm. You know, I went the first year for the first – there was a guy telling me that when they started the school, the first year, a lot of people got in for free so they could get up to speed. And the guy goes, yeah, I went the first year for free. That guy really wanted to kill. Then a buddy of mine from down here went and was there for a few years, and he actually did work for, like, he did mostly like lettering and inking, because his drawing skills never really got up to that level, but he did a lot of stuff for like Simpsons stuff. But he went to that school and he would tell me about it, and I would just drool. I mean, it would just drool about going to a place where so many people of a like mind were doing this sort of stuff, and teachers from Disney and teachers from DC and from Marvel and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, he would come back and tell me, you know, what he had learned, and I would just, like, you know, try to take in as much as I could.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think from what I've heard, like, one of the main takeaways that I've heard from people that work there is that it really instills in you you've got to work. I mean, it's a hard school to get into, and it's a hard school to survive in, from what I understand. And a big part of it is just one of the main lessons you learn there is you want to be here, you've got to draw for hours and hours and hours every day. Mm-hmm. And if you don't do that, you're not going to keep up, and you're not going to last here.
And yeah. And you and the since it, you know, opened in the late 70s, the number of artists that have come out of there, if you just look to them, and most of them are the ones that work. I mean, they'll, you know, they produce so much stuff, and you're thinking, how can they do that? Because they were trained to.
Exactly. Yep. And it's interesting because school, you know, kept a very, you know, low attendance. They, you know, kept it at 150 students at a time. They didn't like flood, you know, the school with like 1,000 people at one time, because they wanted quality instead of quantity going in and out. And, you know, and it's right outside of New York City. It's in Dover, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember seeing in the back of the comic books, the ads for the Kubert School. And I was just like, that was the dream. You know, instead of going to college at first, I wanted to go to the Kubert School.
It's still to this day is the only accredited school devoted entirely to cartooning. It's amazing in this day and age, you'd think that there would be other schools that would pop up. But I think a lot of colleges have programs now. But this is that's why the Kubert School is the school.
Well, I do think that Steve Bissett is tied to one in Vermont. That one's been, unless it's yes. gone or something. There is one other, you know, hate to burst your bubble, Gordon. But,
hey, but I'm just looking at what it says on Wikipedia.
Yeah, there is a Vermont cartoon.
I didn't
school
pull that just out of my butt.
Yeah, yeah, Steve Bissett.
You might as well have.
Steve Bissett, who is
but,
what?
But it should be mentioned that Steve teaches courses in comic art, history, drawing, and film at the Center for Cartoon Studies in White River Junction, Vermont, which is part of another museum or part of another school. So it's not right. just devoted completely to that.
Okay, you are right. I am wrong. You are good. I am evil.
You know, I am going to isolate that right there. That's going to be played on the beginning of every show.
But you know what? That, you know, both schools are pretty solid.
And I looked at both, and I looked at, you know, how much can I rent a trailer for near the school? And it was like, why, this trailer's only $3,000 a month, you know?
plus, this is not to, you know, I'm not beating a dead horse here, but the Kubert School is devoted entirely to drawing and cartooning. The Center for Cartoon Studies is a lot more. I mean, it's writing, it's studying comics. It's a lot bigger of a program than it's not as specialized as.
Okay, school. I got you.
So, I mean, if you want to be an illustrator in comics, if you're willing to work for it and you can get in, the Kubert School is the one that you want to go to. Now, that's not to say that other schools are crap. Because obviously there's a lot of great schools out there that offer programming. But when you're talking about artists, when people talk about, they don't even have to call it the Kubert School. They could call it just the school, because that's pretty much how it's known in the industry.
It's amazing to me, too, that when you consider all the stuff in this world now that you can find classes on or entire schools, you can go to special effects schools and everything, that there's still only one.
That is surprising to me. I think mainly it's because it's because of Joe, really, because not only is he an uber talented artist and illustrator, so he can back up his teachings, but also the fact that, you know, it's the work ethic, the fact that it's a storytelling as well as composition and illustration and anatomy. But also I think, you know, other schools to start up, you would need somebody of Joe's caliber to basically put their name on them in order for them to remain in business. Otherwise they need to get funding from somewhere else. And that's where another school comes in or another program comes in. So I think, you know, like if, you know, just to throw it out there, like if McFarland started a school, it would probably, you know, be similar, but, you know, not really, because they're different people. And you know, I don't know if, you know, maybe in his heyday, that could have been something that would have been started up, but maybe not today.
Yeah.
When you think about what an accomplishment this was for Kubert to start a school, and the school's existed for decades now. This is a comic book guy. It's a guy that draws comics for a living to have the nerve to start a school. You know, like he didn't go to an existing school and start a program there. He built his own school, and I'm sure a lot of people doubted that this was going to last very long. It's really an incredible accomplishment.
Yeah. And it's a credit to his two sons that keep it going as well. I mean, they are their former students, but also that, you know, they all of their studios are right there at the school. So they are not just teachers, but they're currently working all the time as well.
One of my favorite things that came out of the Kubert School was remember the superhero catalogs from the 70s?
Yes.
All the Mego dolls and all the superhero toys and licensed products. There was a company in New Jersey that sold all that stuff, and they contracted the Kubert School to make their catalogs. And it was, they were like comic books. It was the format of a comic book, but it was just,
wasn't that Heroes World that did that?
Yes.
Yeah, I remember those because it was just amazing, the work that came out of it and how they put it together. It was a catalog that looked like a comic. It was awesome.
Oh, yeah, and that was Joe's students were making those things.
Okay, guys, so we've mentioned Sergeant Rock. We've mentioned Tarzan. We mentioned Hawkman. So are there any other characters out there that when you think of them, you think of Joe's work on them first? Or at least in the top, like, three?
Well, I also said Star-Spangled War Stories, which is kind of a Sergeant Rock meets monsters kind of thing.
I'm talking about specific characters.
Well, yeah. Right. Well, like you mentioned, Mike, the Unknown Soldier, big time.
Yes.
And Enemy Ace. Was that, that was also a couple of other people, but Joe had a hand in that too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Did he create it?
He was a co-creator of Enemy Ace, yes.
Oh, okay.
He was also a co-creator of Ragman.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Ragman's a TV star now.
I know. Who'd ever saw we'd see Ragman on TV on a weekly
Never
basis.
Thought I'd see that.
I know. doesn't really owe a lot to Joe's original concept of him, but you know, he's there. So,
oh yeah, definitely.
I don't know if Joe's estate gets a little bit check from that, but I hope so.
I would hope so.
Absolutely.
There was the Viking Prince also.
What's the one that he kind of did off to the side? Is it Tor?
Yes.
Yeah. That was his baby, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Tor has a long history. That's something he created in the 50s for a smaller company at the time. And then he tried to sell it as a comic strip back then as well. And then there was the short DC run in the mid 70s. And then it was revived a couple of times in even more recent years, right? He came back to Tor just in the mid 2000s. He did a new Tor series as well. And this, we should say that Tor is like a prehistoric caveman type character with dinosaurs and all that fun stuff.
Well, one thing I didn't want to go over too fast was Tarzan. The thing is, while we were just doing the show, I went up on Amazon and I went to Amazon Prime and I bought the omnibus of Joe Kubert Tarzan.
I hope you went through the ESO store, didn't you?
Just say yes, Mark. Just say yes.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. For the love of whatever. I'll give you some money later, Mike. Now I forgot what I was going to say. The thing is, with at that time that came out, Edgar Rice Burroughs, the reprinting of the paperbacks and stuff from the 60s and 70s had really been doing really well. The Frazetta covers, and then later there was like the Mars books and the Tarzan books, and all the Edgar Rice Burroughs stuff was really selling. And when Kubert did Tarzan, Bernd Hogarth had done it. He had done this big, nice hardback edition of Tarzan that was really cool, telling the origin story. But Kubert, with working with DC, did a whole bunch of the Tarzan stuff, and it was like nobody caught the flair better, I think, of Burroughs' original vision than Kubert did. I just when I look at him, I think this is the books personified into that world. The villains. I mean, everybody thinks of Tarzan in the jungle riding an elephant or fighting a lion and all that kind of stuff. But there's a whole lot more to Tarzan, and that's what I loved about those the regular comics and the giant size. I've got one or two of those super treasury size books, you know, that came out like a whole dollar with the hard covers and everything. And this stuff really was pretty magical, you know.
Absolutely.
And I still
beautiful work.
Yeah, it was really beautiful. And even when you blew it up, you still saw that it was a guy who was almost sketching, but it worked with Edgar Rice Burroughs. And I cannot praise that work enough. I mean, like I said, I plunked down some money tonight for the book because I had planned on doing it anyway. And in the middle of the conversation, I realized I hadn't picked it up, But yeah, $20 off Amazon. And go through the ESO network when you do it.
You know, they've also got, I noticed too, they've got the IDW put out one of their artist editions of one of his Tarzans as well. Mm-hmm. And that, when I've looked at that, that's one of those artist editions I just look at and go drool. Just, you know, so gorgeous.
Well, just for a second, let me speak as an artist. A great artist, like when I first was a little kid and I looked at Dr. Seuss, or I looked at Jack Kirby when I was about 6 years old, or I looked at Joe Kubert when I was about 10 years old, is that a really good artist, a really great artist, not only entertains you and you're like totally pulled in, but they leave information behind for you to follow. It's almost like breadcrumbs for somebody learning how to draw. And Kubert was one of those guys. There's a lot of artists out there that you kind of go, yeah, it's pretty good and all that kind of stuff, but it's sort of a mystery as to what they do. I think it might even be a little muddied, but Kubert was one of those guys. You're like, wow, I get how this is. And you can actually like look at really super huge copies of the artwork and you can almost feel what they were thinking when they did it. And it's a learning experience. You know, it actually, you know, people go along and they become better artists by looking at guys like that.
Yeah. Question for you. And especially for you, Mark, because you're the main award-winning artist on the show, of course. Because I'm not, you know, as much as I love the medium and of comics, I must say that sometimes my knowledge of certain aspects of it is lacking. And I know that Kubert, as we said, has this sort of loose, sketchy quality to his work, right? Okay. Much like we've mentioned Neil Adams before, Gene Colan's another one that. Maybe more to the extreme, but I find that usually with those kind of artists, those kind of pencilers, really difficult to find a great inker for them. Is there anybody that you guys know that is there a particular inker that he gelled with? Did he use a lot of different inkers? Or are there particular inkers that really brought out the best in Kubert?
Well, I kind of thought that Kubert inked his own stuff.
Does he? Did he?
I always thought he did. So, yeah.
I had a friend of mine that was up at the school, another person I want to kill, that said that he had a special kind of a pen. It was like a cartridge nib, a quill pen or something, or a cartridge brush, something to that effect that he always inked with. And that I got the impression from him, and this is, you know, if there's somebody out there that knows more, please write in, tell me I'm stupid. But that he would like rough in everything, and he knew what he wanted to ink. He knew where the final line needed to go. So he'd do these, you know, sketches of Tarzan, and then he'd come back in, and the honing of it would be in the inking. That's the impression I always got.
And yeah, I think I believe you are correct, Mark. Kubert did mostly his own inking, I think. I'm sure there's amazing exceptions, but
I never saw the reason that I also believe it's true is because from Sergeant Rock, Star Spangled War, Hawkman, and Tarzan, the inking never looked different. Never.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that would show that he did it, you know.
No, totally,
yeah,
makes sense.
That's awesome. I didn't know. And I'm looking at, you know, I'm pulling up some random things that he's worked on at the comic book database here. And I don't see that any inker is usually credited with with stuff. So, I guess that's true. I did not know that. So that's even more impressive.
When you think about it, it's that classic Kubert look that we've been talking about. It gets down to those fine lines. So those are Kubert's own lines that you're looking at.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's very few artists, comic book pencilers that I know that didn't have somebody ink them. But he was the one that I always kind of got that impression that he did the whole shebang. Probably, I don't know if he collected two checks for it or not. I would hope that he would have.
And also, well, for a lot of the work he was doing, certainly in the late 60s and into the 70s, he was in an editorial position at DC also. So he was the guy making those decisions. So if he wanted to ink his own work, he didn't have Julie Schwartz saying, no, hand it to Murphy Anderson. He's going to ink this issue. You know, yeah. That was Kubert's call to make.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Nope. Totally makes sense.
Recently, well, a few years ago, I bought my son the one of the showcases of the Haunted Tank. He gobbled that up. Now, that's got other guys in there, too, like Russ Heath and stuff like that, another great artist.
Oh, yeah.
But he ate that up. He thought that was really good stuff. I bought him. Then I said, oh, here's some Sergeant Rock for you. I am not necessarily a war comic fan. I never really did. But when it came down to it, when a Kubert Sergeant Rock got plunked down in front of you, I would read it and enjoy it quite a bit. I was more of the, you know, Marvel, Jack Kirby, Fantastic Four kind of guy, as you well know. But when one of those got thrown down in front of you, you just had to look at it. And like I said, when I got to Hawkman, it was like, wow, this is great stuff that I am so very happy they reprinted. And then I had always been in love with the Tarzan stuff that he was started. What was it, about 1973?
72 to 77 was his run. So he had about a 5-year run on it. And he wrote and drew, I think, pretty much that whole run.
Did you go through those? Was he pretty loyal to the Burroughs books as he got further along, or?
I'm not sure. At least he was adapting the books. I don't know if he was adapting the books for the whole run or if it drifted in other directions by the end. I'm not sure.
I'm going to find out in a couple of weeks.
That's right. He has another story that I'm a fan of that's kind of lesser known from the late 60s. He did a 3-issue run in Showcase of a character he created called Firehair.
Yep, that was on my list to talk about next.
Yeah, and that's a nice series. He wrote and drew it. It's Showcase 85 through 87, I think. And it,
what years? I'm sorry, what years?
Came out in 1969, okay. I believe.
So, and what's the character?
The comic is called Showcase, which was like an anthology series.
No, that I remember. I just never read Firehair. Yeah,
character's Firehair, and it was a white child, a baby, I guess, who was orphaned, who had red hair, so he got the name Firehair. But he was raised by Native Americans. It was set in the early 1800s, right. I think.
Yes, I heard of that. Mm-hmm. For some reason, I always thought that character was female.
No.
I think they do a female version later on. I think they may have.
Later on, maybe. Yeah,
they may have used that same character concept. But the original was male, and it was just, it's classic Kubert stuff. You know, that it's Old West, and obviously just imagine, you know, outdoors. So just gorgeous stuff for Joe to play with.
Now, was Jonah Hex, when did Jonah Hex come out? Was that a Kubert, or was that somebody else that had started that?
He did some work with Jonah, but I don't think he was the primary on.
No, that. I don't think so.
No.
Right.
And even Firehair was set in the early 1800s, I think, so there wasn't really much crossover with the other Western characters, so it's really its own separate little thing.
Yep.
And I don't know if they've ever even reprinted it.
So huh.
You may have to go back to those late 60s Showcase comics if you can find them. I've got them.
Yeah. Of course.
Come on over.
Come to Chicken Town.
Come to Chicken Town. You'll never leave.
I do think that two of his later works are definitely on my shelf, and I bought them right away. The Sergeant Rock Between Hell and a Hard Place, that was written by Brian Azzarello. I gobbled that up. That was just a great – I think it was his last Sergeant Rock story. Ooh, and he got in the 90s, he did I don't know if it was indie, it might have been DC Vertigo kind of thing, but he did a graphic novel based on real life called Facts from Sarajevo about a friend of his who was trapped in Bosnia, and that got huge acclaim. It was like sort of his Oscar, you know, if you will, his Oscar film or Oscar work.
Yeah, that won a lot of awards that year. I think that was Dark Horse that published it.
Oh, is it Dark Horse?
I think so. But again, it's similar to Will Eisner in that very late in his life and his career, he was still working, still pushing, still trying new things, and started doing several graphic novels. He did a few after that, after Facts from Sarajevo.
That's exactly what I was thinking, Kevin, was the second before you said it. I said, it's like Eisner stuff. I think a lot of people at that time were sort of like, look what Will's doing. Let's talk about let's talk about ourselves or our friends or people that we know. Let's talk about stuff from the gut. And I think that that Sarajevo book, I actually had a at the time that came out, I had a carpenter who was working on bookcases for me in my home, and he was from there, and his uncle had been arrested and then killed by the police and everything like that. And it was like, and so when that came out, it was really powerful stuff. And I don't think we get enough of that in comics. I think that there are guys that really push it. I think Eisner was like one of the earlier people to do it, but I think the Sarajevo book really needs to be, you know, paid attention to, you know?
Absolutely. Sure. No, I think so as well. I mean, I just came off of, I was just actually talking about another, this is a DC Vertigo series, Sheriff of Babylon, which I enjoy quite a bit. And I was on a podcast, Reclamation Society, talking about the first volume. And we were just talking about how these kind of stories, not stuff that we hope that there would be more of these. I mean, there's so much superhero stuff out there, and granted, there's an audience for that that kind of pays the bills in some ways. But mm-hmm. You know, there was a big boom of indie stuff in the 90s, that in the late 80s and 90s, that I think in some ways we're starting to see it happen again, but not nearly as much as it could be, I think.
And this is a general thought, not about Q-Bert or anything else, but is that I think we need more. We need some Army comics. We need some Westerns. We need some, you know, we need to mix it up a little bit. And, you know, there's some great superhero stuff out there too, but I wish that we did have more, a little more diversity than it seems that we have right now.
Well, you have to get away from the DC and Marvel if you want any kind of diversity right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about it is, I mean, we're talking about an artist who did not cut his teeth on superheroes. I mean, yes, he could do it if necessary, but I mean, most of what he did was, you know, real life, real people in extraordinary circumstances. And it would be, you know, if he was around today, you know, starting out today, you know, I don't know if he would be able to tell those same kind of stories.
Mm-mm. I tell him to go to the Q-Bert school. So that's going to wrap it up for this portion. You know, definitely we'll have some of his books up on the ESO store. So please do check it out. Not like Mark does. So.
Shut up.
Truly, definitely worth checking out. If you haven't seen a lot of the different work Q-Bert did, Joe was just amazing. I definitely would recommend it, you know. But with that being said, let's take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment.
Welcome to a Geek Girls Take. I'm your host, Angela, and this week this Geek Girl is talking about the CW series Riverdale. Okay, the second I heard that a show based on Archie was coming to the CW, I was intrigued. I read the comics growing up. I was a girl who liked comics, so I was always given Archie comics by unknowing family members who didn't think girls read superheroes. Spoiler, we do. But it was a comic and something to read, and I was basically never going to give up any type of comics given to me. I ate those things up, and by ate them, I read them. If you have not seen the first episode of Riverdale, there will be spoilers, and you should skip ahead now. Okay. Riverdale is a dark telling of the Archie series. This story starts off at the end of the summer after one of the students, Jason Blossom, has died. We meet Betty, who is getting ready for a date with Archie. This has to be one of my favorite scenes in the first episode, when Betty's friend Kevin sees Archie's new six-pack and lets Betty know that she needs to lock that down. It's silly, but it's also incredibly funny, too. We are also introduced to Veronica and her mother, who have just moved back to Riverdale after her father is caught up in a scandal. Archie has a newfound passion of music and is determined to pursue it. We also learn a lot about his summer and an affair with one of his teachers at school. And can we talk about how excited I am that Josie and the Pussycats are in this show? I am so excited. I just don't like how they made them out to be mean girls right off the bat. I really hope they don't keep this up. And I mean, some attitude is great. They are in high school, but those ladies need to be able to shine as much as the rest of the cast. So I really hope they do more with them. I am so excited to see what else this show has in store for us. I will definitely be tuning in on Thursdays to watch it, and you should probably check it out too if you just listened to this whole thing and didn't watch the first episode. You can find it online, I believe, on thecw.com if you missed it. Thanks for listening to A Geek Girl's Take. What will I talk about next week? Well, you're going to have to listen to find out.
Welcome back. Now it's time for the ESO Con Report.
Well, Kevin, I believe you have an announcement about an upcoming convention that we should probably start with.
Yeah, sure.
Wait a minute. What's Kevin still doing here? Wait, what?
Hey. I'm still here forever. From the world of the Flopcast, we're going to be very busy the weekend of March 3rd to the 5th. I'm going to be up here in Massachusetts, and I'll be at Northeast Comic Con, which, Mike, I know you are familiar with.
I am.
Oh, yeah.
You will be with the dynamic duo.
You are correct. Adam West and Burt Ward will be together at Northeast Comic Con. I'll be wandering around. I'm not doing anything official there, but come find me, anybody that's going to be there. I'll be hanging out all weekend, I believe. Here's the important one, though. That same weekend, March 3rd to the 5th, in Bloomington, Minnesota, which is right outside Minneapolis, right by the airport, right by the Mall of America, we have MarsCon happening. And MarsCon is a science fiction convention, but they also have a whole dedicated track of comedy music, like Dr. Demento, Weird Al style, funny music. They have comedy music concerts all weekend. That whole dementia track, they call it, is programmed by our buddy, the great Luke Ski, who has been on ESO in the past. So Luke has a whole crazy lineup of comedy performers who are going to be headed up that way that weekend. And the headliner for the weekend, I was very, very intrigued by this. They have got for their headliner for the MarsCon Dementia Concerts, Judy Tenuta.
Wow.
So that'll be interesting.
That's a name I haven't heard in a little while. Yeah,
the goddess is going to be there?
The goddess herself shall be there. Yeah. Pretty crazy. So that'll be something. And for our purposes, we wanted to mention MarsCon, and I'm not going to be there this year, unfortunately. I like to get out there when I can. However, my co-host from the Flopcast, Cornflake, will be back at MarsCon. And once again, Mike, I know you're a fan. You know what Cornflake does when she shows up at a convention.
I'm waiting to hear it. I'm waiting to hear the words.
Saturday morning and Sunday morning, Cornflake will be running dementia water aerobics.
Oh, I love it.
So everybody get in the pool, and Cornflake puts on funny music and gets in some exercise for the weekend for you.
That's awesome. That is so awesome. So unique.
Yep. So that's MarsCon. So anybody around the Minneapolis area, get out there, have some fun, see Judy Tenuta, see Cornflake, and get in the pool.
Get in the pool. Maybe we can get Judy in the pool.
Maybe Judy will be in the pool with an accordion.
And flowers in her hair.
Not electric. Yeah. She should be okay.
Yep.
Well, very awesome. Definitely want to check those two shows out. And I would dial it back just a little bit to this month, because we've got two conventions happening in February that ESO personnel are at. First is this weekend. It's the big game weekend, right? I'm safe with that, Mike. Right? Is that right?
So far, my fingers on the button. Don't worry.
Yeah, absolutely. So Sunday, February 5th is the Atlanta Comic Convention. This is a super show that is one of the biggest that well attended Atlanta Comic Conventions of the year. They do four a year, but this one always seems to bring the people out, and we'll be there. Mike and I will be there. There'll be many friends of the station there, including the award-winning Bobby Nash, as well as our good friend J.R. Mounts. He'll be returning to the ACC. He hasn't been there for a couple years, I think, so be good. Always good to see him. Lots of friends of the station going to be there. If you are planning to go, Mike and I don't have a table or anything, so we'll just be hanging out. Mike will be along with the – he'll probably be drooling at the pop figures.
And I always. Come on.
And I will be looking through the probably the $5 trades and maybe some single issues as well. So we'll be there. So like I said, we don't have an official table. So if you're going to be there, you want to meet up, just drop us a line. Let us know when you're going to be there, because we love connecting with people at conventions a lot. It's one of the great things about these gatherings. So it's one of the reasons why I like shouting them out on these shows, because the ESO people like to meet people. And we just, that's why we do this, right? Kind of, maybe.
Yeah, sort of. Maybe.
Right. Well, speaking for myself, that's why I like to do it. So, and other convention that's happening in February 24th through the 26th is Mysticon. That is in Roanoke, Virginia. And you can find our Geek Girl, Geek Girl's Take, Angela Pritchett's going to be there. And then we move to March, not conflicting with the dates that Kevin has already given us. But here in Atlanta, we do have March 10th through the 12th is Joe-Lanta, which has become much more than a G.I. Joe focused show. There's still a lot of Joe content. So if you're into G.I. Joe, particularly the toys, whether it's the old school Joe dolls or the action figure line that came out in the late 80s, maybe, you definitely want to check out Joe-Lanta. But if you're into toys in general, there's it's now become a huge toy show. So and just a lot of fun too. The show has grown much a lot over the years, and it's just a blast. It's well attended, and you definitely want to check out the Possum King Ramblers. Our friends Ricky and Bambi and Jazz put on great music during the day, and then Ricky and Bambi kick it with their band Radio Cult at night. It's a fun weekend, and Mike and I will both be there. I don't think we've got a panel yet assigned to us, but we hope to be doing a couple panels at least. And like I said, we'll also be wandering around just looking at toys. Again, Mike will be with the pop figures, and
Are there any other toys for me? No.
Exactly right. Also happening in March, the 24th through the 26th, is Regeneration Who. That's in Baltimore, Maryland. That is a Doctor Who focused convention. And Angela Pritchett will be at that one. I believe she is a guest at that one. And that same weekend, March 25th to the 26th, down here in the Southeast, it is South Carolina Comic-Con, SC Comic-Con at Greenville, South Carolina. Mike and I have been going to the show. Well, I had to skip it last year, but this has been, I think this is the fourth year for it, and it just keeps getting bigger and better. It is actually a great comic show. Sure, they've got some pop culture guests there too, but comics are the main focus. So if you're interested in comics, if you, I know that Robert, who puts the show on, we talked to him before, and he makes no bones about it. He says his inspiration for putting the show together was Sheldon and Heroes in Charlotte. So this is sort of like a mini, although it's getting bigger and bigger, version of Heroes. A lot of great talent there. I'll have a table, so I'll be selling copies of Tiki Zombie as well as some of the other New Legend stuff. Tiki Zombie artist Peter Cutler will be there. Mike will be there as well. The award-winning Bobby Nash is going to be there. Lots of folks. If you go to scComicCon.com, you can see the entire guest list. Very, very, very excited to be returning to Greenville. It's actually my first Tiki Zombie convention of the year, so I'm very excited for that. And then just real quick, in April, at the end of April, 28th, 29th, is Treklanta here in the Atlanta area. Mike and I will be doing a panel. We're not sure exactly what day it is, but we're very excited. I don't think we can announce the subject yet either, but very excited to be participating in Treklanta. Skipped it last year, so we're very glad to return to it this year. And also at the end of April, the 28th through the 30th, is RavenCon, and that is in Williamsburg, Virginia. Angela Pritchett has got that on her schedule, so you can meet the Geek Girl herself at that convention. And just to real quick, the weekend after that is Wholanta in May 5th through the 7th. That is a Doctor Who convention, which is one of our favorite times of year. It's one of our favorite conventions, so we are very excited to be returning to Wholanta again. Actually, this is the first Wholanta, because prior to that, it was known as Timegate.
And remember, folks, it's no longer a Memorial Day weekend.
Right. It's no longer, it's changed its name. It's changed its date. It's still going to be at the Marriott Century Center. So it's the same hotel as it was been in the last couple of years, but it has changed the dates, and it's sooner. They did have a cancellation. Louise Jameson was supposed to be there, but she had to cancel. But fear not, they're still they're working on another guest. But their main guest is
Colin.
Colin, right. Yes, Colin Baker himself will be there. They've got some other great guests lined up as well. So if you're into Doctor Who, you're in the Southeast area, you want to check that out. And we will be there all weekend long. So that's all the conventions coming up in the next couple months, at least as far as ESO personnel. If you have a convention that you would like us to participate in, please reach out to us because we love helping out with conventions, whether it's at the cons themselves or just promoting them on the show. And if you're going to a convention or if you've been to a convention that you just want to rave about, you want everybody to know about your experience, please reach out to us because we love talking about conventions.
Well, that's going to wrap up another episode of the Air Station One podcast. I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight. Let's thank our guests, of course. Kevin, you made it through.
We've done it again. Always a pleasure, guys. You can always find me on the Flopcast here on the ESO Network every week, but always a special treat to get up here, up on the station, hovering high above Chicken Town with Mike and Mark. This has been fun.
Yes, your 4.5 list was really fun this week about the doctors.
That was our latest episode. Yes, we counted down our 4.5 favorite doctors. And I know that there's one doctor who's very popular on several shows on the station who was not even mentioned. And we're already taking some heat over that.
Dr. Bombay was not mentioned? Oh, my God.
Well, we've kind of got that covered. So, you know.
That's right. On the Flopcast, though, we gave plenty of time to Doc from the Love Boat, so don't worry. We've got our priorities straight in Chicken Town.
Did they ever say what Doc's real name was ever on the show, or was he just Doc?
Oh, yeah, they did. They did. In fact, we reveal his real name on the Flopcast.
So. Uh-huh.
There's a tease.
Wow.
How could you possibly not listen at that point, right? Got to go find out what Doc's name is.
I'm hitting play right now as we speak. Thank you, sir. And Mr. Mark, thank you, my friend.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you guys having me on tonight. It's a good, fun show.
Anything you want to promote or anything? Any cons you're going to be at?
I'm going to be at Pulp Adventure Con in Fort Lauderdale the weekend of the 11th. And then the next weekend, I'm going to be at Pensacon in Pensacola, Florida. That is a great convention. But I'm looking forward to both of them. And, you know, got plenty of stuff coming up. Lots of magazines, lots of book covers, lots of stuff. New Kolchak book coming out soon. I'm doing the cover for, just finished it up, from Moonstone. And so many other things. I've got to try to fit 6 months worth of work into 4 months. So,
wow. Awesome.
That's my situation. Yeah.
I understand that. That is cool. And of course, Mr. Mike.
As always, it's my pleasure.
Hey, anything you want to shout out about, sir?
You know, we're talking about a master illustrator. And I think I got to give a shout out because it just came out today that unfortunately, Bernie Wrightson's art career is over. His health is struggling. He's still fighting. So, he's still with us, but it's been pretty much announced today that, he's pretty much retired from illustrating. And man, this is one guy that we're definitely going to have to do a show about at some point because, you want to talk about master illustrators, but, So anyway, I just wanted to give him a shout out and say that we're thinking about him and his family and hope that he's still around for many, many years to come, even if he's not drawing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Jeez.
Nope, exactly. That's awesome. I know Bernie is such a classic and God, where to start with him? We will do a show probably over the summer when our next artist spotlight. I'll put it on the schedule.
I just hope it's not a tribute show. So.
Yeah. The pictures they showed of him in the hospital, he does not look good.
Yeah, he literally looks like he's fighting. Yeah, I mean, he's been through a lot. And but I mean, he's strong, so I'm hoping that, you know, he's still around for a while.
Yes.
So on this subject, though, maybe we should throw in a quick remembrance to Dan Spiegel. So another great artist who just died today, yes. I believe, or yesterday. He was 96. Yep. And appropriate, I guess, for this episode, because he also had a nice run on Black Hawk for DC. So he was another classic DC war artist.
Yeah. Thanks for that. Because, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. All right. I'm not going to say my shout out because it's too happy, joy, joy after all this depression stuff.
No, go ahead and do it.
No, turn you this should around. Do it.
Now. We should end on a high note, sir.
Oh, no. Okay. I just wanted to give a quick shout out, actually, to the fine folks at Kubo and the Two Strings for, actually, we talked about the Academy Awards at the beginning of the show, and congratulations to Kubo for being nominated for Best Animated Film. You know, that alone is just an honor. And we on the Wits Network have been raving about Kubo, and we've done an episode dedicated to it. We've talked multiple times of the movie, and it's just amazing to see. And I hope it is going to be, you know, make it, you know, and go for it. And I just really want to, you know, give my love for it and my support for it. Yeah, I loved Zootopia. I loved Moana, and it's just, you know, I just think let's go away from the total CGI. Let's go for more of the traditional puppet stuff. And it's just, it was just unique. It was neat to see. And, you know, let's go for something new. And I was so happy to see Finding Dory was not nominated. So, you know, the folks at Pixar, let's get away from sequels. Let's do some new stuff.
Yeah. No offense to Finding Dory, because I love that movie.
Oh, I did too.
I'm not happy that they weren't nominated, but I am. Yes, I'm pulling for Kubo.
With that being said, we will be back again next week when we are going to talk all about sequels that shouldn't have been made. I think, you know, that says it all. And, you know, some people say
special 4-day long podcast.
Gosh, I think Kevin and Cornflake should be on that one because, you know, they like those long shows now.
we did our longest Flopcast ever just a couple of weeks ago. That is correct. Usually we do really, really short shows, though.
Yes, they're the short show of the ESO network.
That's right.
So awesome. So we are going to be talking all about different sequels and which ones, you know, why the hell did they make that? So it should be a lot of fun. Of course, we want to hear from you. Please write us at esopodcast@gmail.com or call us at 404-963-9057. That's going to wrap up the show this week, and we will see you again here next time on the ESO Podcast. Talk to you soon. Peace. And we're done.
You've been listening to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast that explores the many worlds of all things geek. Please write us at esopodcast@gmail.com or call us at 404-963-9057. And if we find what you say interesting, we'll put it up on the air. If you've enjoyed our show, please rate us or leave feedback for us up on iTunes. And while you're there, subscribe to our show or any of the ESO Network podcasts. We can also be found up on Stitcher Radio or wherever fine podcasts are found. ESO is also available up on most social media sites like Facebook, Twitter, and so many more. The show is brought to you by the fine folks at the ESO Amazon.com eStore, where right from our website you can find all kind of geeky goodness. And if you get something up there, you can also help support the station. ESO also has a Zazzle store to buy cool ESO merchandise and such. Show your ESO love with something from Zazzle. To learn more about ESO, our website is esopodcast.com. The show is produced by Calico Productions. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you here next time on the Earth Station 1 podcast. Peace.
It's 106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.